Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is a renowned Australian novelist, playwright, and non-fiction author, best known for a Booker Prize-winning novel, which went on to be adapted into an Oscar-winning film. Thomas Keneally wrote Schindler's Ark in 1982. Since then, he's written extensively about the two world wars, as well as many other historical events. Often combining fact and fiction, Keneally's writing focuses on identity, morality, and egalitarianism. He's been writing for more than half a century, and I'm delighted to say he joins me here today at Hay Festival in the small Welsh town of Hay-on-Wye. Thomas Keneally, thank you very much for joining me here on The Big Interview. Now, we're at Hay Festival, surrounded by hundreds of authors from all over the world. And I wondered what it was then, when you look around at all of these people, that you think back to what first drove you to put pen to paper.
Yes, my case is different in specifics, but I'm sure it's the same impetus that has governed all these people, and that is a certain sense of being marginalized in some way. I notice, for example, a lot of Nigerian writers here, both resident in this country and resident in Nigeria. And it's the question of ethnicity and the way ethnicity puts you in a group and leaves you stranded. In my case, I felt marginalized because I came of Irish people in Australia. The priesthood was a big thing still in those days, long ago. I find it very hard to explain to the young, but I studied for the priesthood and then I left the seminary and I had indeed lost my faith, above all in the people who ran the institution. And we've seen them revealed in recent years for their incompetence in confronting the child abuse thing. But in any case, I was working as a school teacher. I was trying to re-establish myself as a member of society. I was studying law as fast as I could because I wanted to be a lawyer. I've always been a lawyer, Monke. But before I got through that, I wrote a novel, One Long Vacation. You have the summer vacation here. We have a summer vacation which stretches over Christmas for a couple of months. And I wrote a novel, sent it off to the old Castle, the great publisher of dictionaries, and they accepted it. And because I had a certain post-colonial innocence, I knew very few writers. There were a few lonely outcrops of Australian literature, such as Patrick White, and I'd read him. But because I had no one to turn to and ask about publishing, in my innocence, I thought, this is what I'll do. I'll be a writer. It'll be great. I'll just make things up for the rest of my life. And indeed, when my first novel was published, I began to find my way back into the centre of Australian society. And of course, I won't pretend that speaking to women was not a difficulty if you're a ruined monk. Most girls, if you're going to be honest at a bar when a girl asks you what you have been doing, to most robust women, it's a turnoff to say, I'm a ruined monk. But to say, I'm a novelist, that was a great thing in Australia in the 60s, before there was an Australia Council, before the days of the Australians we know, such as Peter Carey and Peter Porter and so on. But you see, I was coming from the fact that I had felt a failure. I'd left my studies. I was in a between limbo state. And that's a very good state from within which to write. And so I'm sure that in some way, everyone here who's written fiction in particular has been marginalized. or sees themselves as alienated from some main structure in some way. And it requires that desire to center yourself to fuel the writing of a novel.
Leaving the church must have been an enormously hard and long decision, or was it something that you just walked away from instantly? You were talking about rehabilitating yourself back into society.
Yes, I felt a bit like a former prisoner, you know, and I did feel that I'd let my clan down, you know, my parents, who actually didn't want me to go, and who into the priesthood, but nonetheless, they then invested themselves in that. And I felt I'd let everyone down in my own fairly working class Irish Australian community back in Oz. And therefore, redemption has been very important to me. And there's nothing, no package of redemption better than a book, a Gutenberg book between clapboards, hardcover, with a glossy jacket and improbable claims on the back page. There's nothing like that to redeem a lost soul.
Yes, you know, your first book, that was back 1964.
Yes, that's right. So I've been writing now 51 years, and I haven't let the fact... I used to say when I taught, in inverted commas, writing at University of California, I used to say you can't let the fact that you can't write stop you from producing literature. If I had let it stop me, I would have still not have published. And I mean, there is a truth behind the witticism, because I think desire makes up for a lot. I've taught, well, when I say taught, you can teach writing, but the person you teach it to has to be very good. and there were many good American writers that I knew as students, such as A.M. Holmes. Do you read her here in Britain? She was a student of, I like to say, of mine, at NYU. And she had a fire in her and a degree of... In some ways, her talent was not as flashy as that of many of the others taking the course, but she had the hunger and the endurance, you know, and that sort of fuel that burns up during the long trajectory of a novel.
Do you have any idea how many books you've written?
I wrote a few under an assumed name once out of pure mischief, but I think...
William Coyle.
And I have written probably about 50 or 60 or something like that.
That's so wonderful. There are so many that you can't even count. let's just talk about William Coyle for a minute. Why?
Well, I thought it would be good fun to write some really narrative-driven stories under an assumed name, and to what fun it would be to have the mystery of whom William Coyle was. I always intended that the name would be a mystery, but the publishers gave it away quite blithely and almost immediately, so there was no mystery. And once that whistle was blown, the fun went out of it. But yeah, I'm a fairly swift writer compared to some. This doesn't mean... As we know, it's quality that matters, and novels aren't a matter of time. But by the standards of many writers, I'm faster. I have a daughter who's just had her first book published in Australia, and she is phenomenal. But it is an entirely personal matter. One hears of how Flaubert, writing Madame Bovary, would argue with himself over a paragraph for a month. And I feel guilty whenever I read that. I think that's what you ought to do. But on the other hand, one is a journeyman writer, and some good things arise out of being a journeyman and journeywoman writer. It is the basis of writing, and many great writers have been journeymen and women writers, including Shakespeare. So one sometimes hopes that one can be brisk and brilliant. They often fight each other, but that's the hope anyhow.
What about awards? Because you started winning awards pretty early on, and of course you've won the biggest literary award that there is to win on the planet, really. How life-changing is that?
Schindler's List was very life-changing. I think one thing that happened was echoed by Kiran Desai, who won with her wonderful book. And she had, in great self-doubt, written three or four novels, and then this novel won. And the first thing she said she thought was, then I am a novelist. They think I'm a novelist. I must be, after all, a novelist. That confirmation, that validation, very important. At the time I won the Booker, I was having all sorts of political brawls and other brawls in Australia. I'm not a very brawly sort of person, but fights I found myself in that were passionate against adversaries who responded by denying the validity of my work. And so I felt rather challenged at the time I won it. And again, that was my feeling. Boy, I must be a writer. If the POMs, my artistic masters, think I'm worthy of a Booker, then these people who read Hardy and George Eliot, even when they're in the pub, if they think I'm a goer, then I must have something. And it did have that very important validation. And movie phenomenon was independent of winning the Booker Prize, but that have also added to the fact that that novel, which is a work of fiction, became the central work of my life. And people say, do you worry about that? And I don't, except that it is in many ways the least characteristic of my works. That may well be why it's such a success. But on the other hand, you think that your habitual work should have merit too, should be seen as having merit too.
Tell me about the reason for writing Schindler's Ark.
The reason for writing Schindler's Ark is that I was fascinated that my metropolitan European betters, given that we Australians are supposed to be the trailer trash of the Southwest Pacific, that they would bring such hysteria and such organisation, such cockeyed organisation and such ardours of technology to exterminating a race as if it were a virus on the soul of Europe. And we know that that is an utter illusion. And such resources, such absurdities of ardour were devoted to it. And I just couldn't believe that as a redneck from Australia. As well as that, my father's involvement in World War II, 3 years in North Africa, gave me somewhat a fascination with the Reich. The fact that he used to send me back material from the battlefields or from the souvenir shops or something, but items of Italian and German equipment. And I held these in my hands as a child and thought, what sort of people did these come from? Of course, ultimately, they came from dead young Germans and dead young, or POWs. But in any case, I had a fascination with the Third Reich to begin with. The fact that my betters had done this and that it was so absurd. I have been lucky all along. I have had great reviews in Britain all along, and even of this last book. And so, again, the British are responsible for this aging Australian continuing to write.
You talk about this last book, and of course it's called Napoleon's Last Island. Tell me about that.
Well, it is about a family of Britons who are on St. Helena in 1815. They're a youngish family, and their oldest daughter is about 14. Their second daughter, Betsy, is 13, and they get a few days' notice that Napoleon's coming to the island as a prisoner. And then within a day of his arrival, they've seen this giant figure, I mean, in terms of imminence, this huge figure land and go into a boarding house in the port. And the next day, he's at their place saying, "Can I stay in your summer house?" And the children of the Balcombes and the parents became enchanted by the presence of this man, because he was very sportive and he was very impish in his wit. And this was the beginning of a situation in which they became friends and enchanted members of Napoleon's extended household. And they began to smuggle letters and financial instruments for him. And when they were thrown off the island 3 years later, the story is told from the point of view of the teenage girl, Betsy. When they're thrown off the island, they live for 6 years in Britain under supervision and under suspicion, because a very Tory government at that stage, not particularly nice people, I have to say, Castlereagh, the government of Lord Liverpool, Castlereagh, Bathurst and so on. Half of our rivers are named after these fellows who killed Britons in massacres at Peterloo and so on. And they spent 6-7 years under suspicion of this government, living more or less under supervision, benign supervision, in the British counties. And then he was in a position to do the government a favour, which he did. It's explained in the book. And he's promised a government post in return. But they don't tell him the government post they're going to find for him is in Australia. And he becomes the first colonial treasurer of Australia. So you have these friends of the great prisoner on a mountaintop island in mid-Atlantic going to the biggest island on Earth, not as prisoners, but as, in a way, as transportees. Mm. And this has fascinated me a lot. I love the furniture of the period, and I love the costume of the period, and am also fascinated by the fact that despite attempts to put Napoleon in the same basket as Stalin and Hitler, it's never quite worked. Even though he was a narcissistic expender of human lives, the fact that he is also the byword for progressive law, the Code Napoleon, for anti-feudalism, for republicanism while being an emperor, and the last word in so many areas of science and fashion, these things make him rather different from entirely negative figures like Hitler. And for example, no one says, "I would like a nice bit of Stalinist furniture for my for my flat," you know. No one says, "I'd like a few Hitlerite enamels," but Napoleonic snuff boxes, yeah.
Now, you mentioned republicanism, and that's really interesting because, of course, you were the first chairman of the Australian Republic Yes. movement. That was back in 91. Is that something that you're still passionate about?
I am, but Australian politics has declined so badly since then that, you know, there are other pressing issues such as the asylum seeker issue, and the environmental issue is a very severe one in Australia, and the climate change one. And so it's still there, and the new Prime Minister is my successor as chairman of the Republican Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. But let me hasten to say to honest Poms, this isn't a Brit avenge thing. This isn't the equivalent of beating England in the ashes. It is entirely an evolutionary constitutional republicanism we're talking about, not republicanism of putting bombs in pubs and sniping at members of the SAS. It's simply the fact that at this stage of our history, it is appropriate, and I know members of the royal family don't think it's inappropriate. In fact, I'd lay money. I've heard at a distance that they cool about us becoming a republic if it ever happens. But it will require both sides of government to be in favour of it. And it is merely replacing the Queen with our own head of state. But we would see that as an event in which the royal family here would be involved in celebration of continuity. So it's not a cultural revolution. We don't want to take down the statue of Queen Victoria outside the Queen Victoria Arcade in Sydney. We don't want to smash coronation mugs. And we don't want, you know, I mean, it is a fraternal and companionable republic we seek, not some low vengeance on Britain.
What do you think is going to happen in Australian politics, given that the head of state seems to change quite frequently at the moment?
Yes, the Prime Minister changes a lot. There is increasing espousal of neoconservative values by politicians, but the Australians, like the British populace on both sides, believe in dignity, equity, education, healthcare, and so on, as a birthright, not as a political indulgence. And this is very different from the Tea Party in America. So one hopes, the best hope for Australia are the Australian people. But then the environmental crisis now is very severe. Last week in our mid-autumn, I went for a hike in temperatures of 28 degrees, which are quite comfortable to us, but it shouldn't be 28 degrees at this time of year. We have had month after month in which the daytime temperatures have not gone below 20. And thus we have bushfire problems, and we've got severe El Nino causing longer droughts. So that is a huge issue for us, and our last Prime Minister didn't believe in it, you know. I mean, that buffoon Turnbull didn't believe in it.
You're also an active member of Sydney Pen. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, we began to publish work by people in detention centres in Australia. Sydney Pen does all the normal work that a pen centre does, but that is try to exert influence by letter writing to rescue writers in detention in various places. So given that we have detention centres in our own Commonwealth, sadly, or excised from our Commonwealth, but in various places off the Australian coast, some located in New Guinea, one in Nauru, and one that the New Guineans have just scrubbed out, actually. But we decided to publish work by people who were detained in our centres in an attempt to show that they were fully paid-up human beings and were not the queue jumpers and malign people and potential terrorists that the politicians said they were. And the woman I did this project with, Rosie Scott, she and I got the leading writers of Australia to write about the issue of refugees and asylum. And we put together what turned out to be a very fine anthology. English Pen got the idea from us, and they're about to produce their own book, which is being launched soon after I returned to Australia. And it's a case of leading British writers in picking up from our example, which is, a very pleasing result. I hope it does some good. None of the effort is any good unless it makes the path of all these displaced persons of the earth, who after all number some 60 million, their path easier. It's a great international problem. But that's what we concentrated on within the structure of Penn.
When you look back at your career and the many, many books, both fiction and non-fiction, that you've written, and of course some of them made into films, you've won enormous prizes, what are you most proud of?
You know, when you're towards the end of the life, you begin to lose the vanity of being a writer. You begin to realise, A, that you're a very imperfect writer at best, and that the world doesn't need your books, that you do, And I'm proudest now, and this is not nonsense, I'm proudest of my relationship with my grandchildren. I'm very proud that my marriage has lasted too, because my wife has been very difficult and it's taken all this time. I'm proud that, you know, we've been 51 years married, but above all, the relationship with the grandchildren, the fact that they call me Tommy and they don't take me seriously and they let me be a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old all over again and play silly games and rap nursery rhymes and poo jokes and body jokes. You know, there is a automated toilet in the middle of the bush on the coastline near Sydney, and it's a walk we do regularly. It's from a place called Mossman to where we live, Manly. And lo and behold, in the midst of this bush track, there is an automated toilet that plays Mozart or really high-class jazz when you press the button and go in. And it's all press button, and you only have to put your hands under the soap and the soap downloads. I believe this is a French invention, this, and I sing a very crass song about that loo that begins, "Always play some Mozart in the loo, it makes you do a more symphonic poo." And this is a great favorite with my grandchildren. Without grandchildren, I wouldn't have gone back to being able to go back to poo jokes and to seeing infinity in a grain of sand, as children do.
Finally, Thomas Keneally, what's next for you?
Well, I'm trying to write. Some of the men I knew stayed in the church. Some of them were apparatchiks and became the sort of blokes who denied everything. Some were decent men, and I knew a whistleblower. And this is about a priest whistleblower, a really fully paid up human being with female friends and even marginally a lover, who is a whistleblower on child abuse. And it's called Crimes of the Father. And I think it'll be out next year. And at present, I'm writing a novel about a 42,000-year-old Homo sapiens who was found in New South Wales, a 42,000-year-old intact skeleton called Mungo Man. I'm trying to recreate his mythic world and the conditions of his existence. And that is delightful, but it's slow. That's like hacking bits of beautiful ice out of a glacier. You know, it's slow work.
Are you ever going to stop?
Well, of course, the great cosmic mincer, which is within sight now, will make me stop, but I hope not to. Even if I go gaga, I'll probably still be trying to write.
Thomas Keneally, thanks very much for joining me here on The Big Interview. You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Georgina Godwin, in conversation with Thomas Keneally, recorded at Hay Literary Festival in Wales. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty and researched by Gaia Lutz. It's edited by Nina Norick. Until next time, all that's left is to say goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.